the very fact of doing that, that it was a protest in the Lutheran sense of nailing the feces on the wall, says that there was still something to protest about. But it was not so much opposition as sluggishness, as that the main line of genetics really could no longer be diffident about it. They weren't opposed to it, but it was a huge cultural change to have to think this much biochemistry and so on. And in fact, I was saying, look, a lot of what we've been doing is now obsolete. We have to make a completely fresh start, look at things in a new way. And there were some folks who were just not about to do that overnight.
Was it a generational thing?
In part.
There's many examples in the history of science where it takes about a generation to disappear. And you were young. You were in your early 20s.
Yeah, but Avery himself was not. So don't forget that.
Right.
But Avery was not a geneticist. So it's marginality as much as generational. Certainly it is. I mean, you have to have students who would then have been trained from the outset to specialize in that direction and not be too encumbered with too much else. And then there are things lost as well as gained in that process. But I guess the image I had then, as much as anybody, was Dobzhansky, a towering figure in the field who had no feel whatever for any kind of chemistry and did not do a lot to encourage it. I know Francis Ryan had lots of problems trying to sustain his place in that department while Dobzhansky was in charge of it.
In that year between the 46 Cold Spring Harbor and 47
Yalta
Conference, what kind of things were happening, how should I phrase it, scientifically? In other words, you had given your results in 46. What was the status by 47?
Well, I think by then Luria had tried the same experiments in E. coli B and failed. He made less of that failure than others. I heard later that Delbert was touting this and saying he's not sure there's anything in it. Novick and Szilard, no, they wouldn't have repeated the experiments until after that. There was no one else who would ask for the strains, and I don't think they would have wanted to. I think there was a certain amount of sense of latitude. Don't jump on somebody's back immediately. It's the first announcement. Give them a little bit of breathing room. You don't see that today. So I'm not sure I would have. I would have had some ambivalence about sending this stuff out. I think if anybody had asked me point blank, would have done it, but I was still very, very busy following up on the first immediate observations. Now, I must have had something started by 46 with Max Zelli, because he interceded in my debate with Leveaux as to whether the recombinant clones really were clones, really were derived from single cells. He was pushing the idea that they were simply continued mixtures of cultures and complementation. That's a perfectly plausible hypothesis for the prototrophs, and he had had his own experience with cross-feeding of nutritional requirements. I resented a little bit the implication that I was not totally aware of both of his work and of that hypothetical possibility, and I'd gone to great pains to exclude it. And this had to do with producing more than one kind of recombinant. And it was very difficult for me to see how you could invoke mixed cultures to account for both a virus-resistant prototroph on the one hand, or a virus-sensitive prototope on the other, virus-resistant segregating is a mark of that kind of a cross. And this would have been a very sensitive indicator. If you have virus sensitivity, you know there are zero virus-resistant cells in that culture, and that's easily demonstrated with mixed cultures. So there were a variety of ways that I was quite certain, almost everybody else wasn't bothered to look at it, that had been excluded, but LaBeouf persisted and said, well, until you've isolated single cells, you shouldn't call them clones, and don't rely on ordinary bacteriological plating methods, you can't be sure, etc., etc. And I continued to give arguments why that was a needless enterprise, but Zelli said, look, it's not that hard, I'll show you how to isolate single cells under the microscope, and it isn't that hard. And so he got involved fairly early in some corroboration. But I think the early experiments that I simply sent him some of my prototrope cultures, and he re-isolated single cells, made clones, and they were still prototropes, and that was his contribution. The first repetition was done by Novi Gonzalard, and that must have been after I got to Wisconsin, and so it would have been in early 48 before that was done. And they did, and they circulated that news, and Luria was quite content with it, and so on. And it was Luca Cavalli Sforza who later on in 48 wrote to me and said that R.A. Fisher had been very much impressed with this work. I'd exchanged reprints with him. I'd met him at Cold Spring Harbor in 47 at the Biometrics Society. Luca at that time was a young postdoc at Cambridge, and Fisher was interested in crossing over and mapping and so on, and correctly thought, with some complications, this might be very good experimental material, and suggested to Cavalli Sforza that he look into it. So he wrote to me, would I send him the strains? Yes, of course I would, etc. And he was the first person who actually jumped wholeheartedly into outside of my own laboratory into working on the system. And within a fairly short time, he made a very important discovery, and that was the so-called HFR, high frequency of recombination strains, which showed just a piece of luck, a particular strain popped up that had a 1,000-fold higher rate of recombination, and just made the technology of crossing very much simpler. Well, we began a collaboration at that time, and it's gone on ever since. He wrote a little piece about that in Genetics. Did you see that?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, I'll have to get that out for you. I think it's quite important.
Okay.
Here, let me just make a note.
Okay. Sure.
So, I was very busy in my own lab. Other people were doing other things. There were more going on phage recombination. During that period, Luria wrote a review in which he referred to the E. coli work and positively affirmed its significance. I guess you'd have to look at the 47 symposium to see what else was happening scientifically. But the most interesting thing relevant to our own work was that Boivin popped up, and did he do this in 46 at all? Well, I don't know if he was there. It was only 47 he published it, but he and Tatum had some correspondence, and he claimed to have some sort of DNA transforming system in E. coli. And since that was exactly what I had gone into bacteria to do in the first place, I was very excited about it, but we were unable to corroborate it, and after a while he was as well, and so there's no way of knowing what was happening there. And it was another 10 or 15 years before we knew how to get DNA into E. coli. So we've had the legacy of K-12 as a byproduct of that technical glitch.
You've commented somewhere that you used the term messy in terms of the laboratory work. I'm wondering whether that was literal or figurative.
You mean my own style?
At this particular period.
Work in bacterial variation generally was very messy. I don't mean any, well, a little bit of experimental technique, but mostly conceptual muddiness. If you didn't even know how to discuss the concept of a gene, it's a little hard to see how you can do very crisp experiments. If you didn't understand the difference between a cell, a clone, a population, likewise, and I think most of the microbiologists at that time were just not accustomed to thinking in those terms. They saw culture and they thought it was an entity. A tube of bacteria was like one organism. And seems unimaginable that one could have that view, but it was quite prevalent at the time. So it became very difficult to understand exactly what it was that others had done or how to. A lot of things that were called transformations of cultures were very clearly overgrowths of selection, sometimes contamination, and so on. So it was a little hard to pick the wheat out of the chaff. The other thing that was often confused with genetic change was enzymatic adaptation. And if you take E. coli under the right conditions, provoke it with lactose, 10 minutes later you have large quantities of a lactose splitting enzyme present in the cells, and that was very muddled with changes of genetic competence to make the enzyme. Totally different phenomenon, but that got mixed up in many of the older people's writings and confusions of that kind.
One other thing that you've commented on, and I had the quote in my notes, but it was in the same time period. You commented about the importance of networking with other scientists, and that you were actually developing that network at this point. From the 46th,
know it or not, I was, yes.
Uh-huh. CHS, yeah. Meeting on, you certainly were thrust into the forefront of being in contact with a huge number of people.
I was very fortunate in the opportunity to do that. Both the happenstance of being at the right place at the right time. That Cold Spring Harbor meeting was an extraordinary opportunity. Since it is simply what happened, I rather took it for granted. It's only in retrospect that I could begin to imagine what would have been the consequences if it simply hadn't existed. Or even worse, if it had, but I, for one reason or another, had not been admitted to it. Did I tell you that Johnny Moore told me that one reason that Francis wanted me to go to work with Tatum was that he thought Tatum would be much more useful for me in introducing me to those networks? And that was, as Johnny said, against the special disability of being a New Yorker, which I shared with Francis, and even more of being a Jewish New Yorker. That Francis thought that those were prior impediments that would need very special attention. I was oblivious to that at the time, but just quote that as something a very dear, wise friend had mentioned.
What was Tatum's status in that community at that time? I mean, was he long and well established by then in 46?
This is a very complicated story, and there's kind of a Beatles school and a Tatum school, and they never had any public dispute on the matter, but a lot of this was going on in the background on the part of their friends. They had been very close collaborators. Tatum was much younger. Well, was he really? Anyhow, he was junior. He had the microbiological and the chemical training, didn't know very much about genetics, although he had the right instincts fairly early. The issue devolves around who should have gotten the credit for the Nobel Prize on biochemical genetics of Neurospora. Now, Ed was not a deep thinker. Very pragmatic kind of person, loved to do experiments, had a very good intuition, and you might say, if you judge by the outcomes, was a lot shrewder and insightful than he made out to be. Some of his articulation of biological issues was fairly shallow, but he had wonderful instincts, and as I say, what he really knew, whether you knew it or not, went deeper than that. And he had a lot of lore that, again, didn't seem to be so obvious at first sight. I'm sure he was thoroughly familiar with Garrod's work, and that Beadle was not, and that was a major anticipation of biochemical genetics. He knew about fungi and how to grow them. I don't think Beadle ever knew anything about that. He had a sense of biochemical pathways. He knew how to actually isolate and crystallize and characterize something. Beadle wouldn't have known how to do a melting point. But Beadle did have the theoretical grasp, the oversight, the strategic insights, and I can't help but feel that he rather resented having to share the glory with Ed. And he did very little to further Ed's career. I don't know if he actually obstructed it, but it's obvious at Stanford that he was either totally incapable, which seems unlikely, or unwilling to go to bat for Ed in terms of getting him a permanent faculty position. This is between 41 and 46. When Beadle went to Caltech, there was no hint that he was going to ask Ed to go down with him. So there are those tensions in that relationship. Now, in my own relationship with him, I think it was pretty clear-sighted. Ed gave me one wonderful thing, and that was E. coli K12, that specific strain that he had worked on, without knowing that there was anything very special about it, but we were all very lucky, but myself in particular. He gave me encouragement, he gave me a laboratory. I can't think that he made a single conceptual contribution to the work. I could be wrong about that. And I said of Francis Ryan that he was very careful to, in his mode of encouraging me, to hold back on his own part, and he didn't, immediately give me all the detailed directions, and he would have been very capable of doing so. I don't think that was the case with Ed. He was there, did all the right things at the right time, and there was, every now and then, something would come to the surface that would tell you that there were things going on that were fairly deep, but you didn't see them very often. So I have no doubt he brought a very special perspective to that work, and that is certainly as deserving as Beadle. There's a lot of I've heard tell from in Jan Sapp's book. He's gone through the Sonneborn papers and the correspondence between Sonneborn and Afrissi. This would have been around 1958. When the Nobel Prize was awarded, and their consternation about that, and what was it for, and what new thing had Beadle done? Well, he'd collaborated with a Frissy part. Have you seen the Burian Zallon stuff about that? Give Dick Burian a call and ask him to send you a bunch of reprints on that. They've gone into that in some detail. They were quite challenging about that. But Beadle was a very aggressive go-getter. Nobody was surprised when he took the presidency of the University of Chicago and so on. It was perfectly obvious over the kinds of ambitions that he had, and had a salutary effect on the development of biology at that level. Lily Kay has written about his role at Caltech as well, pulling biology together and making a big business out of it since 46 and so on. Ed was none of that. Ed loved working in the lab himself and puttering with Neurospora. He loved the organism and did a lot of good things, but he certainly made much more of a contribution in helping develop people, many of them. After his work with Beetle, it was nothing really very startling that came out of his own experimental work.
You mentioned Harriet Taylor earlier, and somewhere in these notes that you had given me, if I remember correctly, you said, here it is, Taylor's paper was an irritant. I was wondering what you were referring to.
No,
I was in 47 somewhere, March of 47.
Oh, that's the paper she gave at Cold Spring Harbor, yes, yes. Yeah, she didn't want to buy a straight Mendelian view. It was pretty mystical. I still can't figure out what she was after trying to read that paper. I saw what she was getting at as a very nice story. There were three or four subunits within the polysaccharide gene in the pneumococcus, and she was trying to make something else out of it, which I couldn't make head or tail out of it. And she was criticizing me for trying to force E. coli into a Mendelian mold. Well, there are problems with that, but they're not the problems that she was addressing. I mean, at the micro level of genetic structure, that's held up very, very well. But the more so I'm trying to think. She was 6 or 7 years older than me, a very attractive an intelligent woman. I was a pretty young teenager when I first came to Columbia. I won't startle you if I'm telling you I had kind of a crush on her, and I had not met many women like that, and I did not succeed in making very much of a personal impression on her given the age issues. I was 16 or 17 year old, and she was in her early 20s, and and I knew that, and I had no unrealistic expectations, but that sort of colors my relationship with her. After a time, she got to recognize I was a peer sparring partner, but I just have to record that as part of why I lamented that we couldn't get to see eye to eye at a little later time. At the same time, she was encouraging that I really had to be. I felt very careful not to get her nervous in any way about my personal attentions, because I thought that would unable to relate to me in the ways that you would be willing to do, talking about papers and so forth. But I watched the progress of her romantic life with some interest, and it was pretty complicated. She ended up marrying Boris and Prissy, as you know.
Well, I'm going to ask the next question, and you can decide how you want to deal with it, because you've already indicated to me some feelings about this, but you were married in the end of 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how you want to talk about that or not talk about that. I'll leave that up to you. But obviously that has to play a point in some of the things that are happening in your life.
Well, let me just give you a few facts, and then I won't go into much more about
it. It's strictly up to you as to what you want to do.
Esther Zimmer was a graduate of Hunter High School, Hunter College. Went to work for Alexander Hollander at NIH. That must have been 42, 43, more or less. Then applied for, thank you very much, a position as graduate student at Stanford. Went to work for Beetle and Tatum as a master's student, and that would have been 45, and she was there for that year, 45, 46. She did some work on a mutant of Neurospora that requires paraminobenzoic acid. I first heard her name in connection with wanting to get hold of the mutant, and in those days, Beetle was farming out. Each biochemical mutant was somebody's personal province. You know, today we make them by the hundreds of thousands, but that's the way it was then. And he was a little bit slow, wanted to give her a chance to work it up and so on. She was not encouraged to stay there and went looking for a job. And when Tatum came east, he agreed to give her a job as a technical assistant. And then after coming to New Haven, she went to work, I think it was for Norman Giles. So she was Giles' research assistant in a group that, I don't know whether Tatum had recruited Giles or was there beforehand, but there was a group of microbiologists in the botany department, and that's where I met her at that time. We spent some time together during that time, and in a rather short period of time, we were married in December, so we met in August. She continued to the common thread of interest was in laboratory work and in genetics, and we went to Wisconsin together, and she continued. I encouraged her to try to get a doctoral degree, which she did in the department, and then she worked in my own laboratory thereafter through the Wisconsin time, and then came with me to Stanford, and up to the time of our divorce. I've encouraged others not to take, you know, the benefit of this experience. The romantic notion of working day and night in the laboratory next to your significant other is fine, productive for a while, but it's not the best way to pursue a long-term relationship. And let me just leave it at that.
Okay. Still looking at my pre-Wisconsin. I'd like to go into, well,